And because the Old Testament doesn't have the bulk of the manuscript evidence that the New Testament does, we're primarily dependent upon archaeological finds. That's the primary source of evidence for the Old Testament. And the last time we were together, we argued against the documentary hypothesis, the idea that different authors wrote the first five books of the Bible at different times in different places, and that Moses was not the traditional author. It was not the real author. And then we argued for the traditional position that Moses is still the best candidate for the author of the first five books of the Bible by far. And we mentioned the problems that are produced when we assume that that was not the case. And so now, you know, rather than say, okay, well, that's five books down, now it's just 34 books to go, since we don't want to spend the next year and a half on Old Testament reliability, we'll just look at a few more books, Joshua, Isaiah, and the book of Daniel. And see, by looking at the first five books, the Pentateuch, and then Joshua, Isaiah, and the book of Daniel, we are basically looking at the eight most contested books of the Old Testament from a liberal scholarship standpoint. Okay, and so if we could show that there's good evidence for these books and the traditional authorship and the authenticity of these books and the traditional dates, then we could, you know, pretty much make a I think it just follows that if you do enough digging, you can make a good case for the other books. Now, Survey of Old Testament Introduction by Gleason Archer Jr. Goes through all the books. So he's got about 500 pages defending the reliability of the Old Testament. And then he's got about five pages just tearing up the Quran in one appendix, the reliability of the Quran, and then five or six pages tearing up the Mormon scriptures, the reliability of the Mormon scriptures, and showing their contradictions. So I'd really recommend that book. Now, with Joshua and the conquest of the Promised Land, archaeologists have unearthed the Amarna tablets, okay, which contain reports from kings in the Palestine area, in the area of what was then called Canaan, the land of Canaan, reports from kings in Palestine to the Egyptian pharaoh requesting assistance against what they called Haparu invaders. Okay? In numerous cases, the reports that these kings are giving coincide point for point with the accounts given in the Israelites' conquest of different tribes, different cities, different villages in the Promised Land. Okay? But the argument that liberal critics use against the Amarna tablets being support for the reliability of Joshua and the conquest of the Promised Land is that there are many areas. There's areas where these guys are saying, you know, Pharaoh, we need your help. Such and such a city is being invaded by these Haparu. Yet, it's a city that, according to the book of Joshua, the Jews did not invade. And so there seems to be some discrepancy there. Well, biblical scholars, Old Testament scholars, have done a study on the word Haparu, and sometimes the P is replaced with a B, in a variant spelling, where it's Habaru, okay? So some thought, you know, maybe that was an ancient way to say Hebrew, and then maybe these are the Hebrews. Well, that's what caused a lot of the problem, because then you've got the Hebrews invading some towns that the Jews didn't invade. What we need to understand is that Abraham was a Hebrew before God even selected him to be the father of the Jewish nation. Some scholars think that Hebrew means from across the river, and it may mean from across the Euphrates River, which is where Abraham originally came from. An ancestor in the Bible, an ancestor of Abraham's name was Eber.
Eber?
Yeah. E-B-E-R. And that's probably where the name Hebrew came from. So apparently his descendants were Hebrews, which means that all Jews were Hebrews, but there's also many non-Jews that were Hebrews as well. If Abraham was one of many Hebrews, and only the descendants of Abraham, and only some of the descendants of Abraham were Jews, because he had Ishmael, and then he had other sons with a later wife, then that tells you there's more Hebrews than just Jews. So if Habaru means Hebrews, then it speaks of apparently nomadic peoples who are closely related to the Jews, but not necessarily the Jews themselves. So in the cases where the Habaru are devastating cities, and the description is as a one-to-one correspondence with that in the book of Joshua, we can safely say, okay, this confirms the biblical account. But when it talks about the Habaru lambasting a city that the Jews never conquered, it's quite possible that it's other Hebrews, other nomadic peoples related to the Jews, who are also Hebrews but not Jewish, that are doing the conquering. And then since Hebrew may just mean from across the river, it may also be other invaders, other nomadic peoples, not even connected to the Hebrews, that just took on that name as well. That happens a lot of times in ancient times where the Chaldeans were the magicians of Babylon, which was called the Chaldean Empire. But later on, magicians who weren't Babylonian, who weren't Chaldean, were later on, they were called Chaldeans. So Xerox was the company that made the first copy machine, and then later on they were calling them all Xerox machines, even though they weren't even from the Xerox company. It became a general term. That might be the case with the Nephilim before the flood. Assuming that none of Noah's sons married a Nephilim lady, which I think is a pretty safe assumption, then you had Nephilim after the flood, who aren't really related to the Nephilim before the flood, but they were probably called Nephilim just because they were giants. There were giants after the flood who reminded people of the stories they heard about the giants before the flood. And so they just carried over the same name. So whatever the case, where there isn't a one-to-one correspondence, that should not be used as evidence against all the solid evidence based upon the agreement from the Amarna tablets. If we just handle it like we handle any other literature, there's tremendous archaeological confirmation, but there's also other peoples that are... You know, I mean, to the Canaanites, I mean, it wasn't important who was coming from at them and, you know, and invading, if they were nomadic people and they weren't related, you know, if they just gave the invaders one generic name, I don't see a problem with that. And
they had that feeling. I mean, any white person that came to America at first was seen by the Indians as the Europeans. And namely the Spanish are...
We're seeing that today now, too. If you're... We're viewing people as Europeans. We're the ones that kind of politically correct look down upon the Europeans in America. And then the blacks are all called African Americans, and number one, that's a whole continent, and you have black nation, you know, black nations in Africa at war with other black nations that don't like the idea of all being clumped together, and then some of our slaves came, I believe, from Jamaica. And apparently so some of the Jamaican Americans are upset to be called African American, to be prejudged just because of the color of their skin, that they're automatically African. And but you know, when you don't know the people real close, it's easy to just clump them under one title. So whether they were all Hebrew invading nomadic tribes or not, It's irrelevant. The fact of the matter is, you have confirmation of numerous battles, and so, you know, basically what liberal scholars do is they say, you know, aside from all this evidence we have in the Amarna tablets, we have no records outside the Bible of the conquest of the Promised Land. You know, so it's like Norman Geisler used to say, with the creed of 1 Corinthians 15:3-8, with the 500 witnesses who saw Jesus risen from the dead, apart from your 500 eyewitnesses, you have no case. You know, I mean, that's you know, not real comforting. If I'm on trial for a crime and my lawyer tells the prosecuting attorney, apart from all your eyewitnesses, you don't have a case, you know, I'm going to go and get another lawyer because he doesn't understand evidence. And now with the book of Isaiah, there's what's called the Deutero-Isaiah theory, that there were actually two different authors of Isaiah. So it's the Deutero-Isaiah theory that the first author wrote the first 39 chapters, and that was before the Babylonian captivity, and then the second author after the Babylonian captivity had begun wrote chapters 40-66. Now the reason why the liberal scholars do this is they're attempting to explain away the phenomenon of fulfilled prophecies. You know, you got a lot of prophecies in chapters 40-66 about Babylon, and they don't want to admit that God wrote the Bible and is predicting the future. So if they can just date that particular book, part of the book, after the prophecies were already fulfilled, then they can argue that, you know, there's no supernatural element in Isaiah. Now there's several problems with this. First off, the author, as you study the book of Isaiah, you find that the author is familiar with the Palestine area, or the area of Israel, or Canaan, but he's not familiar with Babylon. So if this guy is supposed to, in chapters 40-66, be a guy living in captivity in Babylon, he sure didn't give us any evidence that he knew much about the area. He speaks about it as if it's a foreign land, gives us no details about it, though he does give us a lot of details about the Palestine area. There's also predictions of the Medo-Persian overthrow of the Babylonian Empire, where the Medo-Persian Empire overthrew the Babylonian Empire. There's predictions of that in the first section. Now, that occurred in 538 BC. The Babylonian invasion of Israel and destruction of the temple, it occurred in kind of two hits, one in 606 B.C. and the other in 586 B.C. And so if these guys are trying to date the second half after that to try to explain away prophecies made in the second half of the book, they've got a problem here, because in the first half you have predictions that were fulfilled when the Medes and the Persians conquered Babylon in 538 B.C. So even if you put the second half after 606 or 586 B.C., the first half is before that, and you've got predictions made, you know, going as far forward as 538 B.C. So in other words, it doesn't solve the problem. You're still left would fulfill prophecies even in the first half. It goes without saying, some of the most specific prophecies I can't remember if it's the Isaiah 13 passage which mentions King Cyrus by name. And this is like, if you accept the traditional dating, which I believe all the evidence indicates, of about a 720 to 700 B.C., Cyrus didn't come on the scene and conquer the Babylonians, because he was a Persian, until 538 B.C. So you've got like 160 years ahead of time, Cyrus is named. But you also have a similar style in both halves of Isaiah. But by the way, the liberal, you know, if there was a second Isaiah, he was really a lowlife, because he was really trying to, he went way out of his way to pretend he was the first Isaiah, because his style is so close. A lot of times what liberal scholars will say is that ancient prophecy was its own type of genre, its own style of writing, and it was a poetic way of recording history. So if I was going to record the history of the Twin Towers being attacked by terrorists, which occurred September 11th, 2001, which is, you know, about almost 4 months ago, if I was going to record it in this, using this supposed style, I would write, instead of writing 4 months ago, 2 airplanes that were hijacked by terrorists flew into the Twin Towers, killing thousands. Instead, I would record history in this poetic way and say, thus saith the Lord, the day will come when the two twin buildings that tower above all other buildings will come down. And I will judge the people from that land through evil men riding the plains of the country of the towers. You know, stuff like. The fact of the matter is, number one, there is absolutely no. If that's being done in the Bible, there's absolutely no evidence it's being done. It was done anywhere else. So, I mean, it's just like you invent a genre, a style of writing, a poetic style of writing, just to explain away the evidence. And there's no evidence for your style of writing there. And the second thing is, you're just blatantly lying through your teeth. If it happened in the past, don't use the future tense. You know, like, this will happen. if you thought you could jump off of a 10-story building and fly, and you jump off the building and you end up being in a body cast, you know, your mom's not going to walk up to you and say, if you jump off a building that's 10 stories high, you will be in a body cast. You know, she's not going to tell you what's going to, you know, it happened in the past. And so there's no evidence whatsoever for that. But whatever the case, the most specific prophecies fulfilled, I think, in Isaiah, right down to the detail, are found in Isaiah 53. I'll really be honest with you, any Orthodox Jew who reads Isaiah 53 and says that's not talking about Jesus of Nazareth, that's just nothing but evidence that there's a veil over their eyes. I can remember as a Catholic kid when we did the Stations of the Cross every Good Friday at church, we'd read that passage. And I didn't know until years later, after I became a Christian and did a little background study on Isaiah, that I found out that Isaiah and the whole Old Testament was written before Jesus. It sounded to me like, you know, eyewitness accounts, just like Psalm 22 sounds like eyewitness accounts of the crucifixion. So Isaiah 53, you know, that occurred, fulfillment of that occurred in 30 A.D. There is nobody who knows anything about the Old Testament that's going to date Isaiah. It's impossible to date Isaiah after 30 A.D. You had a Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament, the Septuagint, containing Isaiah, and that's 200 years B.C. We've got Hebrew manuscripts in the Dead Sea caves of Isaiah, and that dates back to 100 B.C. So we got copies that date back that far, then obviously the book was written earlier than that. So, there's no scholar who's arguing that the Old Testament was written after Jesus. Everybody has to acknowledge it was before Jesus. So when you get messianic prophecies fulfilled in detail in Isaiah, there's no escape. You can invent 50 Isaiahs, and if you want to believe that, you've got to at least admit that all 50 of them were written before Jesus showed up on the scene, which means you have to acknowledge fulfilled prophecies, which then means why invent 50 authors when ancient tradition tells us there was only one. But the clincher for me is John 12. It's really a shame that Jesus didn't have modern seminary training, because then he would have known about the Deutero-Isaiah theory, and he would have known there was two authors of the book of Isaiah. But being an unlearned man, God incarnate assumed that there was only one Isaiah. So in John 12, verses 37 to 41, it says, "But although he had done so many signs before them, they did not believe in him, that the word of Isaiah the prophet might be fulfilled, which he spoke, 'Lord, who has believed our report, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed?' Therefore they could not believe, because Isaiah said again, 'He has blinded their eyes and hardened their heart, lest they should see with their eyes and understand with their heart, lest they should turn so that I should heal them.' These things Isaiah said when he saw his glory and spoke of him." By the way, I gave you the wrong passage. I don't have the passage here, but there's basically, Jesus is not speaking here. John is speaking, but there are passages where Jesus says, the prophet Isaiah says this, and the prophet Isaiah says that, and when you put them together, he quotes Isaiah from both the first 39 chapters and the last 27 chapters. But in this passage, you see John, he's quoting from the first portion in verse 38, that's from Isaiah 53. And then the second portion about God blinding their eyes, that's Isaiah 6. So the author of John, under divine inspiration, is stating that the same Isaiah who wrote the second half wrote the first half. Okay? But like I say, you can also show that with Jesus and find when Jesus says, Isaiah the prophet says this, Isaiah the prophet says that. And you put those passages together, you find that he quoted Isaiah from both halves. So really, there's no good reason for the liberal critics to invent two Isaiahs. The reason why they're doing it isn't because the evidence points to two. The reason is their anti-supernaturalistic bias. Yeah, they're opposed to the supernatural, they're opposed to prophecies, they're opposed to, they reject, their worldview doesn't allow for God to write a book, so they have to explain these things away, and the easiest way for them to do that is to try to push the dates forward so that the supposed prophecy is being recorded after the event actually occurred.
But there are prophecies on both sides of what they put it there, chapters 139, there's prophecies there. The famous ones are in the first few books.
There's actually, they made this big distinction between the first 39 chapters and the second, and the next, and the last 27. And in actuality, like you said, there really isn't that much of a greater proportion, if there even is a greater proportion, of prophecies about Babylon, for instance, in the second half than there is in the first half. I mean, you find those predictive prophecies in both halves, both concerning Babylon, concerning the Messiah, and so there's really, Isaiah 14, is that a prophecy of Tyre, or is that a prophecy of Babylon?
I'm about Tyre.
Okay. So then it's Ezekiel 28, then it would be Babylon. But you find these prophecies that were fulfilled to a T, hundreds of years, sometimes over 1,000 years later. And Isaiah just spells it out. You know, this is what's going to happen to the Edomites. This is what's going to happen to these all the surrounding nations that mess with Israel. He lets you know what's going to. He says, well, you know, Israel's going to be around in the last days, and Egypt's going to be around in the last days. And a lot of people say, well, big deal. What do you mean, big deal? How many nations continue with their national existence thousands of years later? And then when he says that these other nations get lambasted and wiped off the face of the earth, lo and behold, that's what happened. Now, you talk about the prophecy of Tyre. Now, I don't even remember what book is that. Is that in Isaiah?
Or? Isaiah, because he says that they'll be destroyed and nobody will ever inhabit the land.
And
even to this day, there's nobody there.
And it'll be a barren rock for fishermen to dry out their nets, and that's exactly.
It's a great place for a resort, it's got hot springs, and it's like really good, all this good stuff. People have attempted to build there, but all of a sudden they've stopped.
Yeah.
And to those very days, ever since Alexander burned it down to the ground, it hasn't been inhabited.
Well, I think what happened was the land, the city of Tyre, when they were getting invaded by Alexander the Great, the people to escape. Part of the city was this little island, real close, and so they got in their ships and they thought, now we're safe, we went over here. So what he did, he built a land bridge with debris from the, leveled the city and took all the debris and built a land bridge and marched on and just devastated them. And now, but it's predicted in the scriptures, and I've got that in my No Other Gods, that it would be barren rock. And it would be good for nothing but for fishermen to dry out their nets. To this day, fishermen in that area, you see this barren little rock island, not even one plant growing on it, and nothing but big fishing nets just drying in the sunlight on it. Because it's like, you know, why go all the way back to land when you got this dry, rocky island that's not good for anything? It's a wasteland. You know, so to try to explain away these specific prophecies, you know, I mean, the good thing is that God's got them in a corner because they can only push these dates back so far. We're going to see that with the book of Daniel, with some of the prophecies there. You know, these guys wish they could, predictive prophecy, this isn't just an Old Testament problem either. Okay? Here you got a carpenter who at the most really has 620 followers. Okay, he had 5,000 people flocking to him, but then he purposely preached a message that sent 5,000 of them home. So now, after he rose from the dead, he appeared to 500, so I'm assuming they were believers, at least became believers then. And then you got the 120 in the upper room. Now, whether they were separate people or the 120 is part of the 500, I don't know. So you got a fairly small group, yet Jesus predicted that his gospel would be preached to all nations. Jesus predicted heaven and earth would pass away, but his words would never be passed away, would never pass away. 2,000 years later, it's still a fact. Jesus predicted in Matthew 13, read the parables of Matthew 13, and you've got all these things about his kingdom, basically in the present stage of his kingdom is God ruling in the hearts of believers. He says it starts small like a mustard seed and then it grows bigger than any other plant in the garden. And it's like leaven, a little bit of leaven, and it leavens the whole dough. And he's talking about how the kingdom is going to start small, but it's going to end up spreading throughout the entire earth. Now, this is some pretty bold prophecies for a carpenter from Nazareth to make 2,000 years ago when he's got a small band of followers. And then he also predicted the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. Yeah.
Isaiah 14 is Babylon.
So Isaiah 14 is Babylon. Good, thanks a lot. Usually those corrections don't get made till like 2 years after the lecture was given.
Yeah.
Isaiah 14 is Babylon, and then Ezekiel 28 would be Tyre. And they both refer to Lucifer, but whatever the case, the idea that they can just push the books after the event occurred. That, by the way, the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, 70 A.D., is why so many liberal critics try to date New Testament books after 70 A.D.
Hegel's school, Viktor Hornanek, they proposed that all the books written after the second century. Hegel that said he was in class trying to push some kind of historical point. He was twisting it, but one of his students happened to be a history major. And it was a famous story. His student interrupts him in protest. But Herr Hegel, the facts say otherwise. And Hegel made his famous quote, "So much the worse for the facts."
I don't know that specific quote.
One of his students, Bauer or somebody, maybe it was a B.
I don't know, but most of
Bauer, that's who it was.
Yeah, he was a big gun. Now, Hegel, most of my reading on him was just basically on his philosophy. So I didn't get into his views on the text, although I know that they would be very radical. I'm wondering if it was more, sure it wasn't like Bart or Bultmann or somebody.
The Bauer, I think they had their own.
No, I'm talking about the guy who made the statement. Are you sure it was Hegel?
Oh, yeah, I'm very sure.
Okay. Yeah, but that's something I haven't looked into. But it's, you know, and there are, it's like right-wing Hegelians, left-wing Hegelians. I mean, so, when I studied Hegel, I studied more from as a philosophical system, and those who went in the Marxist direction and those who went in other directions. But a lot of guys who went in the other direction from Marxism did attack the scriptures. So it sounds like, something that...
That's a Bruce quote from some of his guys. They try to push that the whole New Testament, I mean, the first writing of the New Testament was after the second century.
Yeah, and that's real, that sounds like scholarship that's about at least 150, if not 200 years old. I mean, after that point, there just was no way to justify it. So they had to start Yeah, a lot of what I don't like about conservative scholars today is that we say, you know, Matthew wrote his gospel around 60 AD and Mark in the 50s and John in the 90s, which may be the case, and Luke probably around 60, but we, our conservative scholars are giving in too much to the liberal critics, and so it's almost like the goal of a conservative New Testament scholar is to date the New Testament as late as he possibly can and still hold to the traditional author. But I don't think we need to do that. I think if their arguments are crumbling, and if these dates were like 200 AD, and now they're moving back towards 70 AD, and now even earlier than 70 AD, then I think we need to say that the liberal project was a failed project. Let's get back to the traditional dates. And the reason why it's Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John is because the early church, the apostolic fathers and the guys after them, said that's the order we got them in. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. I mean, Papias, this guy was a pupil of the Apostle John. He said, you know, Matthew wrote his gospel in the 30s A.D. It was the first gospel written. He read it originally in Hebrew, then he translated it into Greek.
When they say Hebrew, they actually mean Aramaic.
He probably means Aramaic there, yeah. And Aramaic was that basically considered the Hebrew of that day.
That's interesting. But it's not the Hebrew of the Old Testament.
No.
The style
that
the gospel.
But you will find some Aramaic in the Old Testament, but not a whole lot. I mean, you're still talking a small portion, but you will find some. And but I believe Papias uses the word Hebrew, but everybody knows he means Aramaic. Mark's gospel, according to Papias, was probably written about 44 A.D. when Peter departed Rome. Mark wrote the gospel that Peter gave him, but they try to use it as Peter's departure from the earth when he died, 67 A.D. So they put Mark at about 68 A.D. But Carsten P. Thiede argues that nowhere in Greek literature is that word for departure ever used in a symbolic sense unless the context demands it. Like in 2 Peter, when Peter is talking about his departure is near, the whole context is saying, hey, I'm going to die, guys. But in Papias' account, it's like, hey, look, Mark and Peter were in Rome. Peter left. Mark wrote the gospel that Peter had given him for the Romans.
I heard this thing on Mark.
So that's 44 A.D.
That Peter, that's in the Greek in Mark. I think it's 2 Mark, chapter 2 in Mark. Most of it is written in a third person plural, as if they're reminiscing. Some of the third person plural, meaning Peter, somebody's talking to Mark and he's writing it down, and it's in third person singular. Mark's writing it down reminiscing. In Mark chapter 2, where it talks about Peter, John, his brother, went to his mother-in-law's house, and Jesus healed. It's all in the third person, plural. So it could be translated, remember when we went to my house?
If that is the case, and I haven't looked into it, but if that is the case, that would give some credence to, there's an ancient legend that Mark was that Mark's mother owned the upper room.
Yeah.
And that, Mark was the young man who, when they grabbed his cloak, he ran away naked. So he wasn't an apostle, but he was a young guy who hung out with Jesus and the apostles.
I think that's in the third person singular, if I remember. But Epic Bruce did a study on that, which is phenomenal. And he also believes that he doesn't name which manuscripts, but he says some of them are written as if they were notes, as if they were being written when Jesus was speaking.
My view is that's what my view has been, that if I was God and I became a man, and I was going to teach guys pick 12 guys, one's a traitor, so you really only got 11. I was going to spend most of my time training these guys. I would pick one of them to take notes. When you look at the 12 apostles, the by far the leading candidate is to be stenographer or secretary would be Matthew, the tax collector. And that's why I think his original gospel was written in Aramaic, the notes of Jesus, Jesus' sermon notes. And he didn't have to put the historical events down because everybody who was familiar with the Palestine area knew what went on. But then, about 42 to 44 A.D., I think it was 42 A.D., the apostles got, through persecution, had to flee the Palestine area. So then Matthew, in accordance with my theory, said, okay, now I have to translate it into Greek because I'm going to be preaching to non-Jews and even some Jews who don't speak Hebrew or Aramaic. However, I better put some of the events, give them some context, because they're going to be from faraway lands. They're not going to know that Jesus performed this miracle, that he did this, that he died on the cross, and things like that. So, and then the interesting thing is that these New Testament scholars, liberal critics, that are investigating all this, they claim Mark was written first. I think that's false, just blatantly false. But they're looking for they call it the Q document. They've never seen it. There's no evidence for it, except that they believe that there were just sayings of Jesus without events. And I'm open to a Q-type document, but it would be Matthew's sermon notes on Jesus.
Yeah, I'm kind of still itching the Q document. When we last talked about it, I was doing some study on that. Matthew said Matthew copied some of his stuff. Matthew's called the Logia. Nobody knows what the Logia is, mm-hmm. but some think it's the Q document you mentioned, but Matthew's the only one that mentions this mm-hmm. extra source that Matthew, he says Luke, I think, too, copied from the Logia, too.
I'll have to look into that because... I've got all of Papias' stuff. There's only a few fragments that he has.
Yeah.
Eusebius gives just about all of them. But in the Apostolic Fathers, you have every fragment that Papias that we have in existence of Papias. I'll have to look into it. But I remember that from Papias, my study of Papias, the big distinction he made between the spoken word and the written word. And he almost sounds like he was saying the spoken word had more authority. And he really wasn't saying that. What he was basically saying was, look, we got the written word of God. But you guys got to understand, I knew the authors. Okay? So I didn't settle a dispute thinking I'm brilliant and I'm going to figure it out by exegeting Paul's letter or Matthew's letter. I just went and talked to him. So for him, the abiding voice of the apostles, I remember his big distinction there. Don't get me wrong, too, I don't believe in Q. Q doesn't exist, never did exist. But I'm saying if there was a Q-type document, then I think that it would be Matthew's sermon notes on Jesus.
It wasn't in the early church, they would preach the Acts of Jesus, and once you were saved, then they'd give you... Some thought that the Q document was just a teaching guide. Okay, now that you're a Christian, here's the teachings of Jesus and how to live and everything. Hence that the Logia. But there's no evidence of the Logia.
I think what they're trying to argue, the liberal critics are trying to argue, is that Jesus was more of a philosopher type. So like Confucius, and he made these proverbs, these philosophical statements, these great one-liners. And there were 50 or 60 of these, whatever, a small amount of them. They weren't related to each other, just these famous things. And then a following built around him, and then they started making legends about, oh yeah, and he was a miracle worker, and he raised the dead, and he claimed to be God, and stuff like that. So both adding to the sayings as well as inventing events that occur. But now, with their strict, unfair rules that they place upon the New Testament, that they don't place upon any other writing from ancient literature, other than the Old Testament, there's just they've studied the text so closely that now they've got egg on their face because by their own principles they have to admit to the reality. Now, Jesus' seminar doesn't admit to the reality of almost anything in the New Testament, in the Gospels, but they're using that outdated scholarship. And that's why they're frowned upon by European scholars and New Testament scholars who aren't even believers. But a statement, like I went over with my class at King's West, a statement that was really difficult to reject, and so most New Testament critics acknowledged that it was a statement that Jesus actually did utter, was when he said,